The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 27, 2020. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Well, good morning, everybody. Good to see you all. Well, this morning, what I'd like to talk about is bad stuff, I guess. I don't know. There's a phrase that was kicked around. Well, I must put it this way, too, that I feel like maybe many of us these days are feeling like we're living in times when a lot of bad stuff is going on. And so I'd just like to maybe say a few things about that, and then maybe you'll have some questions or things you'd like to discuss. But anyway, it was, I remember some years ago I used this little thing. Actually, it was probably back in the 70s or 80s possibly, when this kind of phrase was popular, which I'm not going to use, but it was, I'll just say stuff happens. The word that was used for that is a bit crude, so I'll avoid it here, but perhaps you know the word. But anyway, I'll just say so. But the implication in that word is that bad stuff happens. And so I had this list that somebody gave me this many years ago. Now, I'm sure I talked about it once at some point, 20, 30 years ago maybe. On this list, it has the different religions of the world are listed. And it starts out with Taoism, and it just simply says bad stuff happens. But it does it in one word. The bad stuff part is just a single word. But bad stuff happens. And then the various religions, I'm not going to list them all, because I don't know how people might react to the various listings here. But and then some are just kind of silly, I guess. But, Hinduism, that bad stuff has happened, this bad stuff has happened before. Well, here's Catholicism, is if bad stuff happens, I deserved it. And that's one of them. Protestantism, just to balance that out, perhaps, bad stuff won't happen if I work harder. You know, and I was raised in that tradition, so I can kind of relate to that. But they list all kinds of things here. Among them are the list here is Buddhism, which basically just says if bad stuff happens, it isn't really bad stuff. Now, I don't know about the other religions that are listed here, and I could go on, I got quite a few, but I'm reluctant to do that. But if bad stuff happens, it isn't really bad stuff. That's Buddhism. And I don't know about the other religions, how well these lines capture them. Maybe there's some, I mean, like I said, I was raised Protestant, and yeah, if bad stuff won't happen if I work harder. Yeah, that was part of the work ethic, whatever I was raised with. But in the case of Buddhism, I think that this really does get to a very subtle point that in Buddhist teachings. But I also think it can be taken in a very superficial way, or it can even be taken in a way where it seems like it's just so much denial or something like this that you're really not facing reality. So bad stuff happens, but it isn't really bad stuff, like a bit of a cop-out or something like that. But that isn't it at all. That isn't what is being said here. If bad stuff happens, it isn't really bad stuff. Well, what is it if bad stuff happens? And as I said, right now, I think many of us probably feel that on a very large scale, at an all-pervasive scale here, and reaching into every aspect of our lives, bad stuff is happening. And it looks like it's going to continue, at least for a while. Of course, in a sense, isn't bad stuff always happening? But again, what is bad stuff? This is what we will look at in Buddhism, without really labeling it bad stuff. But we just look at life, at reality, as it's coming up, and what we're dealing with, what we're facing every day, every moment, and what is coming up here. And can we characterize it in some way as bad stuff or good stuff or whatever. Of course, we have a teaching that I've used it plenty of times, about the wise Chinese farmer. Those of you who have heard me talk before, no doubt you've run into this with me talking. Who can say what's good or bad, says the wise Chinese farmer, as his fortunes, you know, seem to turn day by day, and his neighbor comes over to either commiserate with him for the bad stuff that happened or to congratulate him for the good stuff. And the farmer would only say, time after time, well, who can say? And that's, you know, you've heard this plenty of times. And that can also start to seem like, okay, yeah, so it depends on how you look at it or how you're facing it. But still, bad stuff happens. And I already indicated here that I think that this point here, that if bad stuff happens, it isn't really bad stuff. This gets really to the heart of the Buddha's insight. And if we can see this, you won't really have that much of a hard time, I don't think, with what we're facing now or at any time in your life, really. Even though still, difficult times will come. This is not a denial of that. It is not putting it aside or closing our eyes or putting on rose-colored glasses or something like that. That's not Buddhism at all. Buddhist teachings are about directing our attention right to what is taking place moment by moment. And if we can actually see what is taking place moment by moment, we will not get caught up in ideas and thinking about bad stuff or good stuff. When we see the world in those terms, and I want to explore this, why do we see the world in those terms? When we do, which is pretty normal for most of us, this is how we see things. This is good, that's bad. I want to avoid the things that are bad, which of course is stuff that's, for the most part, it's stuff that's bad for me. It's hurtful to me. It's scary to me. It's sickening to me. And that's kind of how we're taking things. But we can also, then the other stuff, the good stuff, we go the opposite direction with it too. Oh, this is wonderful. This is great. I am so lucky that this happened and all of that. Either way, we're just really tossed about. And then over time, pretty soon, wow, this was so good. Like the wise Chinese farmer, the next day, turned out because of that, now this happened, and that's not so good. But then something else happens, and on and on it goes. That right there does tell us, and I've used that story plenty of times, and that does tell us something about how we shouldn't really be too tossed away by the fortunes, good fortunes or bad fortune of the moment or of the day or of the time. But even so, that is still somewhat superficial. Well, I wouldn't call it superficial anymore at this point. If we could really see that and start to live out and remind ourselves from moment to moment, now, we don't need to be so caught up in this moment. If it's really a sad and painful moment for us, a frightening moment, but it will pass. It will pass. Of course, be replaced by other things. But not only will this sort of thing pass, but it will return too. And the good stuff, the happy times. And even though it might seem that in bleak times that you'll never have another happy moment, you know, I've been there. We've all known that, I think, from time to time. But times change. Things move on. But we will grasp at these moments, and then we identify some as, well, this is good. This was happy. This was, you know, and I want that. I want some more of that. I hope that will happen to me again. One of the religions kind of relates to this in a way. but I don't dare recite it here. I shouldn't have brought that up. I'm sorry. Anyway, but this is where we are, and it's so easy for us to be tossed about. But beyond just noting that, which is quite true, who can say what is good? How can you interpret what is happening to you now or in this moment, either to you personally or on a larger scale around you in your society or whatever? Who can determine this when the circumstances that might fall from this are going to come out in all sorts of ways? And any one of those, well, who can say? Yeah, there's some real truth to that. But more than that, in Buddhism, that's actually kind of a Taoist way of thinking, which is quite compatible with Buddhism. And so we don't put this down. Right. That's an important thing to remember, if you can just bring yourself back to that in a painful moment. Just remember that this will change, and in ways you can't predict very often. And in Buddhism, too, we don't encourage you to try to make the favorable circumstances come about. Don't work too hard on that. I mean, maybe a small scale, a little bit here and there. But the reason for that is because you're putting your mind in, well, can I say a bad place as opposed to a good place? I won't say a bad place as opposed to a good place, because this is the problem that we suffer from, is that we think of things in those terms. And what the two great deep insights of the Buddha, what he came to realize, and what his teaching is based on, that would be helpful if we could remember these, if we could. The problem is that we can't really understand them, at least when we first hear them. It takes a while. But the one is, of course, that we don't find a permanent self. That we aren't something here that is persisting. Not just me, myself, my body, my mind, my feelings, my emotions, my thoughts. None of this is persisting. And that's pretty easy to identify, to notice that this is, yeah, that's the case really. But even so, we have a deep underlying conviction that there is something here, me, I, that is persisting. And even though these non-persisting things, these flighty things that come and go, well, they still keep washing over me. And some are good and some are bad. But some I like and some I don't want to have at all. And so we're now tossed away once again. But we don't quite understand when the Buddha pointed out that we don't find a self. If we don't find any, and really what he's saying is we don't find anything persisting. Not in the field of stuff out there that appears to be coming and going, or even here within whatever it is you might think of as yourself. Whether it is your body or some aspect of your mind or your beliefs or something, whatever it might be. You don't find anything that's persisting. And yet, even though... when we first approached this, I remember when I first heard this, I was actually quite young. I was 8 or 9 years old when I first, when this was first pointed out to me. Buddhism teaches this. Utterly, even as a kid, I mean, it was just utterly baffling to me. I couldn't understand that at all. And into my early adult years, it still was very strange, very mysterious. So gradually, I was realized there's something about this that I didn't understand. And why would anybody say this? What would they come up with? And what are they even looking at? And I had long ago, by that time, passed the crazy things that, you know, we might think of, like when you go look in a mirror, well, there I am. I mean, I can see myself there. You know, the Buddha's insight is going way beyond questions such as, of course, there's your image in the mirror, ever changing. But there it is. So we can start to realize in coming back to this and noticing this, we can start to see that there isn't anything that is persisting within the experience. Gradually,
what we can wake up to is this is life. This is why we have this lively experience of everything here in this lively nature, you know, of things. Though we don't have to necessarily become elated over that and start to celebrate it or something. I mean, that's fine too. We might feel that way, but that is what we'll tend to do. What's that again? Well, that's our grasping, you see. And we like that, you know, that there's this life and all that. Yes, wow. And we can feel gratitude for it. You know, I certainly feel that. But what's the grasp about it? It's really just a matter of recognizing it and seeing, you know, just what this is. But the other thing that's linked to this, this is kind of really where I wanted to go this morning, I think, is in assuming that we have this permanent self here that's enjoying or dreading or hating all of these things that come and go. Well, we hate some and rejoice in others and all of that. You know that. But it is all fleeting, coming and going. Of course, we're constantly being replaced with other stuff coming along. That's what this life is. Yeah, but it'll come to an end. Well, yeah, we think that because we see, well, I'm this thing that's persisting now, and I'll come to an end. No, there's some dread in that. But that dread or that rejoicing, whatever the feeling might be, is there because we grasp. And the grasping is there because we think there's something there to be grasped. But this is just our thinking. This is just the assumptions that we have. It doesn't come from direct observations of what is experienced moment after moment in such a way that you've never known anything else but this continuous appearance of coming and going, this continuous appearance of change, and not recognizing that is, I could say it's what your life is, but that is just what life is. That is reality. And that doesn't change. The thing that we long for and look for, that we'll try to pin ourselves down as this thing that doesn't change me, and this is the thing I want to preserve here, you won't find anything like that. That's the Buddha's insight. But there is this, can I say, it's not a thing. But there is this aspect of life that it's always thus. And how is it? Well, it is just what is experienced moment by moment, continuously. And so, in seeing things in that way, and then with this too, this is the important part here, is that if we truly see that, can't be an intellectual seeing. Intellectually, perhaps many of you already, yeah, you grasp this idea that I'm putting. And there's an idea, kind of, yeah. But I'm trying to, there's something more than just an idea here. There is the actual visceral experience of this and realizing that this is truly what the reality is. Just this very thing that cannot be grasped. And yet, it is experienced, it is seen, it is felt. And this is what we need to wake up to. It's hard to wake up to that when there's this other aspect where it's our conceptual experience that is constantly shouting and screaming and rejoicing vocally or in any other way, drowning out our ability to truly notice that. Words fail here, but I was going to say like the basis of all of this that is taken, but it's not, but then it makes it sound like it's a thing. It's not a thing. It's this very liveliness that is actually happening, but it is not of any particularness. It is simply always thus. And if we see that, if we realize that, if we can awaken to that, then you can see how when these other things do come along, they're passing by, the times we are living in, all of this, as well as the individuated little things and the bigger things that are also coming on, physical things, mental, you know, objects of concepts, ideas, thoughts, beliefs, all of it we can see, when we see the true nature of what is passing by, and the wonderful, glorious, but also intimidating sometimes and scary aspects of this, then we don't need to be so tossed away. And as times become perhaps seemingly very frightening for us, you know, very difficult, threatening, or goes to the happy side too, but even so, we don't need to be carried away. Still, we can enjoy the happy moment. We will feel the sadness. We lose a loved one. We can feel the sadness. Maybe sob and feel, you know, deeply that sadness. But it flows on and moves on. And here it is. Again, just this moment, always coming up, still alive. Still, we'll have memories of the happy times that are now gone, seemingly forever. Were they ever really here, though? But gone. Because in a sense, all of this is gone. All of this has yet to arrive. And when is it actually here? Well, what this is right here now, this is the life that's being lived out. This is what it is. And it holds death, loss, all of this is right in, it's in the richness of everything that is taking place. And to the extent that this becomes, and if we see it, if we truly see it, this will become more real than I'm here, sitting here in front of a table talking to. That's real enough. It's tangible. I can feel my desk in front of me here, where I can see the computer, all you guys on the screen. That's why I paused at the beginning. I got to get it back into the gallery view. I want to look at as many of you as I can, so I know that I'm actually talking to a group of people instead of myself. So, but anyway, but that's what I'm experiencing. And same for you, what you're experiencing. This isn't a denial of any of that. But when we see the true nature of what is unfolding here, if we truly see this, then even though, yes, we'll feel the sadness, you know, the happiness, the, whatever it is that the moment is calling for, that it's bringing to us, and it's all passing away. If we truly understand this, and this requires kind of a minimum involvement of yourself, and that is just kind of quieted down. It doesn't even really need to show up. Much of the time, even though we're not fully awake to what's taking place, it doesn't show up. You're not constantly thinking about yourself and that sort of thing. And yet still, very quickly, it's right there and governing what you might do next or say next or think or whatever. But it is possible, and it doesn't mean that once we wake up that we lose that entirely either, you know. But the shift that occurs here is that we can finally see, and we're living out of the true nature of what is unfolding here, rather than out of the phantoms of the various things that come and go and carry us away. And this is a great freedom for us. So we have this phrase here that Buddhism says that if bad stuff happens, it isn't really bad stuff. If good stuff happens, it isn't really good stuff. What is it? And we'll ask ourselves that too. My teacher, Katagiri Roshi, he used to, every now and then he would bring this up. I've given it to him many times. Here it is.
You're frozen.
I got a warning here that I was frozen, but I guess you all see me, right? You can... Okay. Where was I? I think what I'll do at this point, I probably have said pretty much everything I want to say. Oh, I got a sign here. It's coming. I don't know what's going on. I'll continue assuming you hear me, but I think at this point maybe I think I've said pretty much what I was going to say, so... And I don't know where I was now. So, as my teacher used to say, where I am. He'd lose track of it. He wouldn't say, where am I? He'd say, where I am. So anyway, so I'll pause here since I don't know where I am. So if you have any questions, I can see the blue hands here. If you have any questions or comments or observations that come to mind. Yeah, Thomas.
You were about to say, so the phrase, if bad stuff happens, it's not really bad stuff, means or is accurate insofar as you were about to explain how.
Oh, yes.
Was arguably making a subtle point.
Right. Yes. Yes, that's right. I was about to get into my thunderous ending here. So, yes. Thank you. Okay. So this phrase here, if stuff happens, it isn't really stuff. Oh, I've just gone back to the, there you are. Okay. Yeah, I wanted to bring it back to that then. So, because I could seem, as I said, it could seem like a phrase like that, if bad stuff happens, but it isn't really bad stuff. So it's like, yeah, we can just talk ourselves out of it. We can kid ourselves and something like that. But that isn't it at all. There is a very subtle understanding that comes with this. And this is something, you don't need to figure this out. This is not an intellectual proposition. It's not a proposition of any kind. It's not an argument. It's not a hypothesis. It is a matter of just really carefully looking at what is taking place here. And you'll see directly for yourself that you cannot get hold of it in any way. You can't characterize it in any way. Oh, another point, too, I wanted to make about this. I was going to make it earlier, and I did skip over it. And that is, to even put things in terms of good or bad, the awakened don't do this. It isn't a matter, because good and bad, this belongs to this world of our grasping, governed by our likes, our dislikes, and things of this nature. What the concern is, what the focus is what the awakened see, they're just looking at in terms of wholesomeness, as opposed to being too concerned with the particulars, which comes with the grasping. The particulars belongs exclusively to our world of conceptualizing, the world of this and that, the world that we constantly are occupied with and want to arrange in ways that please me, that keep me comfortable and not living out of fear and this sort of thing. And many of these things, to the extent that we are grasping, are going to, they'll be thwarted. There will be fearful things. Like right now, we're coming up in very unsettled times. And I think for many of us, it is quite fearful. And it's troubling for me, too. But I'm not losing sleep over it or anything of that sort, even though I am deeply concerned about it. In fact, I've been talking lately on these kinds of talks in an effort to maybe help us to regain our sane minds and things of this sort. The last several talks, well, actually since we've been doing this Zooming thing, have been sort of been in the back of my mind much of the time. Because I do think it is quite serious and something that we need to be giving attention to. And there's things I feel like I could point out for any of you who might be interested in anything I might have to say. So I'm not dismissing any of this at all. But then it's another thing to kind of lose our minds over this and that sort of thing. Still, we can really feel. I remember when I got word that Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, it just felt like it just took the wind out of my sails. The other thing, too, like with finally waking, if we can be awake to what is taking place here. Sometimes people think, well, gosh, if you become enlightened or something, you're just going to go sailing easy and you won't feel any pain. That's not true. You don't become like a cold fish and you lose all your emotional feelings or reactions or things like this. You're a human being. This doesn't change. So it isn't a matter that we become numb to it or it becomes glossed over or, something like that. Bad stuff happens, but it's not really bad stuff. It's nothing like that at all. bad stuff. Yeah, we can understand what that is. But to call it bad, to label it that way, and then that throws it into this dualism that, where we can, it has a flip side then. Well, we want the good stuff. We want, and with that, we will continue to make life a struggle. And trying to work it and twist it and bend it into a way that makes sense for me, especially. But of course, then we say, well, yeah, but for all of us, my friends, my nation, my country, my world, my planet, all of that. But it's that throwing it into those terms of good and bad. The awakened, the focus is not on good versus bad. It's on what is wholesome versus what is unwholesome. And what is wholesome, this isn't wholesomeness like Wonder Bread. I don't know, is that even around anymore? It's wholesome in what, I don't know, different ways. Or it was from my childhood, I guess. I don't remember now. But, so it's like wholesome, but which is that white balloon bread isn't particularly wholesome, really. But it's not wholesome in that way, in that sense, as opposed to unwholesome, which necessarily then means it has to be bad or something like that. Because we're not talking good and bad here. We're talking reality, which is there is of the whole, which is of the perceptual, which is of the direct experience, which is of seeing birth and death in each moment. That is the very life that is being lived out, and that this never changes. It is always thus. That is of the wholesome. And then there's the world of the particulars, the world of you and me and this and that and the computer screen. It's a matter of seeing things in terms of the wholesome rather than in terms of good, and seeing things in terms of what is not wholesome. And not wholesome just simply means is not considering the whole. For example, again today, using our political situation, I know some of you aren't here in the U.S., but you see what's going on, and the U.S. is a big enough place and country and influential enough, at least it has been. Maybe we've lost a lot of it now, but where people would be concerned with what goes on here. But it's not the stuff that's in the air that we feel and breathe. And I don't mean just the smoke, but I would include that too. Though at least here it's become a little less smoky. We've had, even here in Minnesota, we had this reddish sun, all day long from smoke coming from the fires out west. But all of these things, particularly these things that we human beings do with our powerful, unlike any other animal on this planet, we have these incredible powers of mind and technology and all of this that we can make such huge differences. But when our minds are only seeing things in terms of the fractured world of this and that, I remember years ago I was working as a surveyor many, many years ago now. But there was one of the people I worked with on the crew that I was on was from the prairies of the middle United States here, where there wasn't a tree. He grew up without trees. It was just flat and treeless, And I remember working on this thing, and it looked like we would have to tell the builders, it was big construction and stuff, but they were going to have to move or destroy these trees, take down these trees. And to this person, it's like, well, they're just trees. You don't need trees. Because you can live a life without trees. But that's all I meant. It was just a commodity. And it was just, these trees are in our way here. We can just remove them. Well, there's many other things that are taking place there. It isn't just the trees alone. And, of course, this was a small thing relative to the size of the earth and all of that, But still, we carry out these kinds of things. We want to take oil from the North Slope of Alaska without really realizing. This is a pristine ground. Well, that's, we have it. It's frozen. It's way up there. There's nothing growing up there. We'll have attitudes like this. when we see things in a fractured way, not realizing that that north slope, even though nobody lives there, very few, is connected to the rest of the planet in all sorts of subtle ways. So it's a matter then of not losing the awakened. Do not lose sight of the whole. I've pointed this out many times. That's something to remember. It isn't that they do not lose sight of the good, because the good can't be established even by the awakened. That's not the way to see it, because good will be something pitted against bad. But we can see what is being looked at in a very limited way. Well, there's profits to be made by taking that oil from the North Slope. You know, and that's the focus. So we make everything else come around to that. Never mind what else is going on this planet. Or we can remove these trees, right? Because I also have a background in biology. I don't remember now what my concern was about those trees, but I realized that that wasn't the way. It would cause trouble, problems. Anyway, so it's a matter of as best we can, like I say, the awaken, living out of awakeness. You don't lose sight of the whole. You're looking at things in these terms. And it doesn't mean that we can't act in the small sphere, you know, and remove this or replace this with something else here and there, but very carefully. We didn't really understand this of the laws of ecology and that sort of thing back in the earlier days of exploration and expansion and all of that, where we would move into territories and bring in new plants and animals and things like this. There was a woman back in the 19th century who, I think it was a woman, but it was a nice thought, it was a beautiful thought. She wanted all the birds that were ever mentioned by Shakespeare, she wanted to have them transplanted to England. and she was very wealthy, I guess, and so she carried out some of these. But it was a perfectly innocent thing because I think, well, you put these birds here, what will they do? I mean, they're just birds there's ecology. These things are all interconnected. They're going to act in new and strange ways. Brought the rabbit to Australia, and now it's overrun with rabbits because the rabbit didn't have any natural predators in Australia. And they breed rather quickly. They have a legend or a reputation for that. So anyway, but it's this sort of thing, and we can move a little more slowly. We can look outside of our own personal interest or the interest of our family or our party or our country and take a broader view of things. And always check your heart. Watch where you are in your personal life to the extent that I've learned to not be so occupied with myself and my personal wants and things like this. I live a far happier life now than when those things occupied me more. And why is it? Well, it's living out of a more awakened, wholesome, open understanding. This is why, too, in the Buddha, a line that I like out of the Dhammapada, I've given it to you many times, 183rd verse of the Dhammapada, where he says, to do what is wholesome, to avoid what is unwholesome, purify your own mind. Watch your own mind. This is the teaching of the awakened. And it's that last line there. This is what the awakened teach. And that's it. And that's what we need to get in touch with. And with this, then, yeah, we would see that, well, the bad stuff is not really bad, necessarily. You don't have to look at it that way. It might not be wholesome. Yeah, maybe there's something, you know, but now again, you're considering the whole. But we don't have to treat it as bad. Ish, get it out of here. Destroy it. You know, that isn't the approach. That isn't the attitude. That's not the spirit of this. And it's also patience and trying to be understanding. You can understand others and how they might not act in these ways because they don't know. It's never occurred to them. It's never been pointed out for them. Even when it is pointed out to us, it might take a while for us to start to see the wisdom behind this. And I think, too, for those of us now in these very troubled times, I think for many of us, and again, I feel it as well, but it might be helpful for us if we can come back to this a bit. Well, I think I did finally maybe say everything that I kind of had in mind, I think. Nothing else seems to be there. Thank you, Tom, for bringing me back. Okay. Anything else? Any questions now?
Hi, Steve. I'm just new to this. I've just got the Zoom meeting detail a few days back through Jed. And I just have a very basic question on this. Before there were mountain and after there are no mountain. And now there are mountains. How do you understand that?
Ah. did you have something more? Is that it? Is that the question?
Yeah, I can tell you how I understand it, but maybe I will let you first say how you understand it, so I don't speak too much.
Yeah, well, I'd like to know how you understand it.
Oh, okay. So how I understand is that first, we think that they are mountain, intrinsically existing, right? So there is an intrinsic mountain which is real and exists from its own side, right? And then there are no mountain, which means that there is only this moment here now, and nothing has a name. We don't know what anything is, but everything happens, through causes and conditions, and then disappear when the causes and conditions are not there anymore. A match, I just lit up a match and there is a fire there because there are causes and conditions for the fire, the wood and the air and everything. And then when all this condition disappears, there is no fire anymore. So the same with the mountain. So in this moment, there is a mountain, right? In this being time, there is the mountain. But we don't have to give it a name. It's just something happens through causes and conditions. So that's the number two, where I live only in this here now moment reality. And I don't think about anything else. And then in the third part, it's just conventionally, I can say, I can design it as a mountain. But I have seen the magic, right? I know that in reality, this is just an appearance which comes through causes and conditions and will disappear when these causes and conditions aren't there anymore. But conventionally, just for the sake of communication, I can say, that's a mountain, because we agree, in kind of intersubjective agreement, if there is such a thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty good. But there's something else that's actually taking place there. When we get to number two, we realize that there is no mountain. That is that there is no mountain. There isn't anything at all in particular that is the mountain. And this was the case all along, even when we were at number one there, where we say there's mountain, there's mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. This is where most of us are. We're born into the world, we're taught about mountains and rivers and trees and plants and people and cars and houses and all of this. And they're all real. This is reality. It consists of all these various objects and things. That's the first one. Mountains are mountains. Rivers are rivers. It's just our conventional reality as we normally understand it. But then at some point, we can realize that, and it isn't just because, I was kind of alluding to this, I thought, at least when I was talking this morning, it isn't just because we can see that everything is constantly changing. Everything about the mountain is constantly changing, and it's only conventionally that we'll pull it together. That's part, there is that kind of insight, and that can be pretty powerful. And sometimes people think that that's it, that that's enlightenment itself. Is right there at number two. But then we can come back to the conventional view, so we can talk together and this sort of thing. We agree, this is a mountain and this is a river and that sort of thing. That would be the third, as you kind of described it, I think. But actually, if we go back to number two there, it's more than just seeing that the mountain isn't a mountain because it is constantly changing, or it's made up of various parts and things that they themselves are also changing, and this sort of thing. We can actually, at some point, we can actually see that there is no mountain. There is nothing. It's impossible for there to be a mountain. it just can't possibly be. And that is seeing there's no mountain. It is impossible. There's no mountain. There's no me. There's no, you know, there's no hand. This, we can see this. There truly is not this. Glimmers of this can start to come to us sometimes when it starts to feel like the world isn't quite so real as we naively thought. I remember years and years ago, my mother, she just bought a new car. It was back in, I guess, in 67, because I remember she bought a 67 Malibu, which was a pretty sporty car for my mother, who was getting older. You know, it was, she was in her it was in her 60s or so. And I thought, Mom, you buy, you know, it was after I'd moved out of the house and everything. Why didn't you get a car like that when I was at home? But anyway, and she drove it pretty wildly too. But one day, not long after she had bought the car, from her house, from the kitchen window in her house, you could kind of look across the yard there and you could see the garage. And when the garage door, which was behind, you know, facing away from the house, was closed, if you looked out, say, in the evening or when it was getting dark, which is when this event took place, the window would be darkened, you know, so she couldn't see, you know, through the window. Well, one evening, she was just having to glance out there, and she saw a light coming in through the window. So she knew something was up. It was like the garage door, the main door, was open. So she walked out there, came around the corner of the garage, and sure enough, the garage door was open, and her car was gone. Somebody had broken in, stole the car. And then as she was telling this story to me, and she said, and she came back to the house. She was coming back. She was just kind of wringing her hands. She said, it can't be. It can't be. You know, and it's like this is just impossible. This can't be reality. You know, and it was such a shock for her. Turned out they found the car a few blocks away, the police. So it wasn't a tragic ending to this story. But anyway, but it was that moment. I remember when she was, you know, saying that. That it can't be, it can't be. But it's this kind of, I don't know if you've ever experienced something like that, not necessarily the shock of a loss, like, or at least you think momentarily that you've lost something like that, but any number of things where you can look at it, you see it, you experience it, and you have that intense feeling, this can't be. This is that second stage. Mountains are not mountains. Rivers are not rivers. And if we actually, and it's a visceral thing, it's not an intellectual thing, it's not the idea of it. You with your gut, of course, it isn't your gut, it's just because you can't be either. This can be seen directly. And oftentimes people take this to be enlightenment, which is far more powerful than the one you were describing earlier. But even this is still not, this is still delusion. Then we go to that third step. But there's a car there. There's a hand there. There's a garage there. There's whatever. It is still here. There's a river there, a mountain. And at this point, now we can maybe realize. If we actually see that, and we don't get confused now, we can see what it is that, say, Nagarjuna is saying when he points out that things are empty. That everything has this same taste, he said. And this taste is emptiness, shunyata. But it is that these things are without substantiality. This can be seen and known directly. And in doing that, of course, now this matter of bad stuff happens, but it isn't really bad. Now we're seeing it even at a more intense level than I was speaking of earlier today. But that is what's behind that. It is quite powerful. I've talked with people who think, well, with square, with three, we get back to square one. You know, now, once again, rivers are rivers. Oh, phew, now we're back to this. But that's not it at all. We can penetrate into the true nature of a river or a house or a car or whatever it might be. You, your neighbor. And this is available to us to see directly. It is not a thought, a belief. And I'm not making an argument here for anything. Either we see this or we do not. And it is possible for any of us to see it because actually we all see this. every moment. It is our perceptual experience which does not give us a car or a house or a hand or me or you, something that relates to my name, Steve. What is the perceptual, the direct, immediate, direct experience of reality doesn't give you anything. There's no car. Mountains are not mountains. Rivers are not rivers. But this itself is still not enlightenment. As who wrote the Merging and Difference in Unity anyway, there's a line in there where he says, merging with absolute is still not enlightenment. So at number two, it's kind of like, yeah, we've encountered no absolute. There's no mountain, no river. This is still not enlightenment. Then we go on to three. Mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. But now it is seen and realized that they are empty. To use Nagarjuna's words, and I would capitalize it only to remove it from other words we would confuse that with, like the emptiness we might feel when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, something like that. We're not talking about that. Things are empty of substantiality. And that's number three. But yes, so here we have a mountain, we have a river, whatever it might be. But it is not of the nature that we naively thought at number one, or even at number two, when we realized that there's something about this that isn't real at all. But here it is. So my teacher used to say, here it is, whatever it might be, you hold up your hand. Here it is, but what is it? And of course, then we will try to answer that question, what, but you can't. That's posed there only for you to realize you keep pursuing that. You'll never answer it. You might come up with an answer, like, you know, at number two there, you, about the mountain or the river. That is no mountain and no river. But that's still a grasped thing. That's still a concept, an idea. And that is not enlightenment. But it's showing the emptiness of it. And everything has this taste. You can look now at anything, the tree, the squirrel, doesn't have to be physical things, just a thought, an idea, a belief. All has the same taste, as Nagarjuna would say. And this taste is emptiness, or shunyata is the word he used. Which emptiness, I've started using non-substantiality now, which I think maybe gets, because there's problems with that word emptiness or voidness. And sometimes it's even called nothingness, which clearly is not the case because there's a hand here. This is not nothing. The experience is never nothing. But it is finally really tasting, realizing, waking up to what the direct perceptual experience is that is always ongoing. It is the same for you as it is for a Buddha or an awakened person. We all taste, see, feel, experience reality directly. And it is of one taste. And if you taste it, you'll realize it. And then, of course, that can throw us into no mountains, no rivers. That's still delusion. But here's a mountain, here's a river, here's a hand, here's whatever it might be. But that's number three. And there we have awakening. I usually don't go this far. Is it Yasin? Thank you for bringing that up. Did that help at all?
Yes, definitely. I think that Nagarjuna was saying that, like, it's harder to see, like, the emptiness of something when it's actually functioning. So it's easier to see, like, the emptiness of a broken car or a broken phone than the emptiness of the phone or the car when it's working. But even when it's working, it just appears and it doesn't belong to anyone. It's just an appearance through causes and conditions, because I've got eyes consciousness,
right,
all the different things, and it appears, but it doesn't belong to anyone.
Yeah, exactly. And you're quite right. With that functioning, everything is pulled in with it. Yeah, that's true. And so as you see the thing, the whole universe, the whole reality, the whole of reality is appearing in everything that is appearing here. That also becomes abundantly clear at the same time when it stops being a thing for you.
Hmm.
Yeah. I just finished a book where I get into this stuff to some degree, which I think might be helpful. In fact, it's the beginning of the book. I open it with those three lines. First, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. This is delusion. Next, mountains are not mountains, rivers are not rivers. This is necessary, but still delusion. Then, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. That's the opening of my book. That's before the book opened. I hope you don't skip over that page.
So it's almost like we create a contrast so that we can see the first one better, right? Almost.
Well, it's just a matter of...
When you say it's necessary... Sorry.
It's for awakening. It is necessary to see that rivers are not rivers and mountains are not mountains.
Hmm.
And you are not you. You know, the hand is not the hand. So this like my mother was saying, this cannot be. It's a lot more than that, Mom. Of course, at the time she had that experience, I didn't understand this myself. I was only, 20 years old or something, maybe. I don't know. But I hope... I hope that helped.
Ken, looks like you have a question or comment. Why don't you go ahead?
Yes, thank you. We've mentioned that we live at the intersection between the relative and the absolute, that we don't throw out either views. And my question is, conventionally speaking, if we were living in Tibet in 1959, and we saw the Chinese coming, or if we were living as Native Americans and we saw the white man coming, would we be having this conversation in the same spirit, or would you be emphasizing the same points?
Yes, I would have emphasized the same points, yes. Nothing would be different. What I was pointing to there is universal. And so the circumstances, because I was pointing to the perceptual, what the perceptual experience is, and it has nothing to do with the layout of the conceptual, how the world is arranged. Also, I wouldn't use the phrase that we live at the intersection of the relative and absolute, only because it sounds like they're two linear things that are crossing, and that's really not the case. They're both kind of all-pervasive, and we're constantly there. There's no other arrangement. It's always these two together at once. And ultimately, too, and this is what occurs in the number three step of mountains are mountains and mountains are not mountains, is that the realization is that these are not two, the relative and absolute.
Yes, thank you.
But it's a matter of seeing that and not a matter of believing it or getting the idea. It is possible to see in that way. And that is actual, full awakening, if that occurs. Yeah, but thank you, Ken. I hope that helped.
Michael Jordan, again, thanks for your patience. You can go ahead and unmute yourself. Looks like you're out.
Yeah, actually, it's kind of in a similar vein. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. One of the things that I get, and it's happened a lot this week, is I teach all my classes now Zoom, and I'll have students say, well, Professor Jordan, the world's ending. Did you hear she died? And one of the things that they say to me, it's kind of paraphrasing them. It's like, well, yeah, I know. I see all these Buddhist books in your office. And I don't want to hear that mountains or mountains stuff. Because, hey, the Supreme Court's going to hell. that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, what would you say to them in that context? It's like, that's nice teaching, but this is real stuff. There really is a Supreme Court. There really is a this. There really is a that. She's dead. And look at what's happened.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's much of an opportunity to lay it out in any depth, like at least not right away, because it takes a while for us to kind of move toward this sort of understanding. I took a few liberties here. Normally, I don't speak quite that way on a Sunday morning, but I went as far as I did go this morning. Something just drew me on. But what you could say under those circumstances is that just remind them that times change and things continue to change. we live in this world of coming and going, and that includes each of us individually, and certainly including Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But we are living now in living out this dynamic reality. And it's a matter of just coming back to this moment here and then doing what you can. I might remind them a little bit of just maybe realize that there is the whole of totality of where everything is taking place. And we can see things in that context rather than we got to get this point and drive it through. And pretty soon we're acting in just a malicious and way that we would view others who want to attack us or have some kind of power over us or something like this. So it's a matter of, so I'd at least try to introduce maybe a little bit of thinking about putting your mind on the whole a little bit, you know, something like that. But of course in this, and I would say even today, I didn't intend to do this, but it just sort of came up when I mentioned how I felt getting news that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had died. I mean, it was just, it was a blow to the gut. I mean, it was just, but still, we have to go on. I think it probably took me a few days to feel like I can, you know, breathe again or something, you know. So it doesn't mean that we don't feel these things and we might be upset by these things, but little by little we can maybe learn to keep our mind focused on the whole picture as much as we can. Get out of our own personal stuff. And of course, this is more than, you know, when someone like Ginsburg dying is more than just our personal stuff. Yeah, we, you know. And it is an enormous influence across the country and that sort of thing. But still, it is a matter of if we can bring our, well, as the Buddha said, you know, do what is wholesome, do what is of the whole, avoid what is unwholesome, and watch your own mind. I think that's a very good teaching. Just try to calm them down. Also, perhaps remind that, and we can function a little better to the extent that we can keep our minds settled and calm, not losing sight of what's actually unfolding around us, and what is malicious and fractured and divided and painful and all of that. Don't lose sight of that either. But don't ourselves start acting in a way that's participating in that, in the fracturing and in the division and all of that. So I don't know, Michael, did I...
Yeah, that's very helpful. I find that what happens is that they want to draw me into a discussion about how this is it.
Right.
You know, you're right, this is it.
Mm. That's what we'll lock down on, the smaller thing, the thing that we can grapple with and get hold of and start slinging around, you know, or we want to build up, all of that kind of stuff. That's, yeah, we go there right away. But it's helpful to slow down and look at the larger picture.
When all else fails, I just remind them that I finally accept the fact that my beard is gray.
There you go. But you look very distinguished with a gray beard.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Michael. Good to see you. And I guess that's it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.